Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for February 17, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we have a thematic convergence tonight, one of those rare moments, a look at the state of the contemporary university academia in the United States. First, I'll speak with Jennifer Washburn, author of the book University, Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education, just out from Basic Books. And then a little after the half-hour mark, John Wiener, author of the book Historians in Trouble, which is all about fraud and plagiarism and all kinds of things. But I think we'll also get him a little commentary on the Ward Churchill crisis at the moment. And this book just out from the New Press. So before we get to all that, thanks to all of you who pledged during this spot last week. And thanks to all of you who pledged during all the other spots. And please do make good on your pledges when the bills come, or don't deny the charges when they show up in the credit card, please. And also, now we're returning, of course, to the usual diet of economic headlines. It's been a while since I've done that. The economy chugs along with actually little change from the last time I did this many weeks ago. Recovering, expanding, but not very exuberantly, not very happily. Although, one exception, this morning it was reported by the Department of Labor that the weekly tally of first-time claims for jobless for unemployment insurance, a very sensitive indicator of the state of the labor market, since it tallies people who went to their local unemployment offices last week to register for benefits, having just lost their jobs, that fell by 2,000 to 302,000, the lowest level in almost 5 years, basically, the lowest level since before the stock market fell apart in the recession and a strange recovery period began. So at least the pace of job loss is slowed, but what the real question is whether the pace of hiring is going to increase, and that's not clear yet. The tally of people continuing to claim unemployment benefits, that is not first-time people, but people who've been drawing for several weeks already. That also fell, but it's still kind of high. So we're not quite sure the job market is recovering exuberantly yet. And about 12 days ago, the government reported, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported on the state of the job market in January. Most analysts have been expecting close to a gain of about 200,000 jobs, and that fell over 50,000 short of that expectation. Just 146,000 jobs added. The long-term average in the United States would be in the neighborhood of 220,000, so we're still running well below average. We've got about a deficiency of close to 10 million jobs, what we would normally be experiencing some 38 months after the end of a recession. So job market expanding, but rather weakly. And the unemployment rate is actually, it's looking pretty low at 5.2%, just a little below its long-term historical average, actually. It's being depressed by the fact that a large number of people have simply dropped out of the labor force, presumably because they are very discouraged by job prospects. If all those people were in the labor force and therefore counted as unemployed, and remember, to be counted as officially unemployed, you have to be actively looking for work in some fashion. If those people were counted as part of the labor force, the unemployment rate would be over 7% right now. So that is not a good number. So pace of job loss slowing, but the pace of hiring really not picking up. And remember, in an average year, the U.S. economy destroys about 35 million jobs and adds about 37 million. That's why you get a net gain of 2 million over the course of a typical year. But a lot of turbulence under that. So the destruction and creation continuing apace, but creation not moving very rapidly right now. The Washington Post, ABC News weekly measure of consumer attitudes, stuck at minus 10 for the second week in a row, pretty weak reading, and people's evaluations of the national economy deteriorating their own personal finances improving a bit, but their evaluation of the national economy deteriorating. So consumers are not extremely happy about the state of the U.S. economy. But that doesn't stop people from borrowing heavily against the value of their houses. They've been doing a lot of that for the last several years, and they continue to do that and spend the proceeds. And let's hope they're not stuck with, as they say, upside down, that is, owing more money than their house is worth, should the job market weaken, or should the housing market weaken, or should interest rates rise significantly and the value of their monthly mortgage payments go up. So people professing not great optimism, acting a little more optimistically, at least some of them, than they're professing. But sowing some seeds of some strangeness in the future, I think. Although some of the leading indicators are picking up, that is, the measures designed to forecast the direction of the economy in the coming months. The Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index was up last week, and it took a pretty deep slide in the second part of last year, but it has been recovering in the last few weeks. So that may mean that the slowdown that we saw late last year, continuing into early this year, may be coming to an end, but it's not booming, so I wouldn't get carried away with that analysis yet. Also, counseling some degree of caution is the Conference Board, another institution that compiles a leading index. Its leading index off in January by 0.3%. It increased in December and November, but it had fallen for the 5 months before that. So this is sputtering, it looks like. Not an economy falling apart, but not one really gathering a lot of steam either. The Canadian job market, looking at a couple of our neighbors, the Canadian job market disappointed last month. Employment fell by 5,700 jobs in the month of January. Unemployment rate held steady at 7% north of the border. And this is the third consecutive month that the Canadian job market disappointed expectations. So things not going so well up there. Mexico, however, reporting very strong economic growth in the last quarter of last year, 4.9%, accelerating for every quarter last year. It's about six consecutive quarters now, seven consecutive quarters, accelerating growth rates. So Mexican economy doing pretty well. Of course, employment, as it has been in the United States, not doing anywhere near as well as these headline numbers, but at least the GDP numbers are expanding, which is better than them contracting, at least. And then finally, in congressional testimony today, Alan Greenspan, chair of the Federal Reserve, who only has about a year left in his term, and then we can be saying goodbye to that fellow, he says that ownership is the key in Social Security reform. He thinks that people should have private accounts for really social, political, psychological reasons, that they feel that they have a stake in the capitalist system by owning stocks. He didn't put it quite this way, but this is his meaning. It'd be very interesting if this should ever come to pass. Anytime that there's a proposal to increase minimum wages or any kind of union-friendly legislation around, they can always say, well, they're going after your retirement portfolio. And they can get workers then to identify with the interests of those well above them on the economic ladder. Be a great confidence trick. I'm a little less convinced that they're going to get away with it than I thought a few months ago. Certainly the Bush privatization scheme running into some bumps in the road. But when you have a lot of powerful and rich people with their interests, ideological and material interests solidly aligned, they may well turn out to get what they want. So we shall see. But that sinister ideological side effect foregrounded by Alan Greenspan talking to Congress today. So let's take a little break with this bit of music from Paul Van Eyck and come back with Jennifer Washburn. And that an excerpt from Paul Van Dyke's Go Mix, G-O-H. I don't know if it's pronounced or spelled or what, but that's from about 5 years ago. And we'll hear a little bit more of that at the bottom of the hour. And now we're joined in the studio by Jennifer Washburn, author of the book University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. And before we speak with Jennifer, I should say she'll be reading at the Blue Stockings Bookstore this coming Wednesday, February 23rd, 7 p.m., Blue Stockings on the Lower East Side of Manhattan at 172 Allen. That's between Stanton and Rivington. Again, that's next Wednesday at 7 p.m., and I'll repeat that at the end of the segment. Welcome to the studio, Jennifer.
Thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here.
The University Inc., the Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. And in the early part of the book, you review some of the history. And it's always easy to think that things used to be so much better in the past. But in fact, there was a period in American history when universities were practically wholly owned by rich folks and run by such. And academic freedom is actually, or the notion of it, is somewhat a recent innovation. Could you review some of that history for us?
Yeah, sure. Certainly at the turn of the century of the 1860s and when the research university was born, industry and universities had very close alliances. And as moving forward, as you see the rise of chemical engineering departments and electrical engineering departments, these departments really rose up very much hand in hand with what was happening in the commercial sector and in industry. Agricultural schools always had very close ties to farmers and so if this is not a new phenomenon, although what I really try to argue in the book, which the reason I called it University Inc. and really am saying that something very new is going on here, is that since about 1980, universities have become much more commercially involved themselves. What I mean by that is that the professors and the universities themselves are now trying to profit off of their own research. And this is a fundamental change. And in the past, universities would do consulting work for private industry. Their professors might have consulting arrangements with private industry, spend maybe 20% of their time helping industry to solve some technical problem they were having. But the professors never had any financial stake in that research, and they really remained based at the academy, and their research was put into the public domain. And what we're seeing now is a new kind of proprietary notion of how to handle knowledge, so that universities are actually patenting their professors' discoveries. Then they license them to private industry in exchange for royalty revenues. And so it's become like a real profit center for the university, and this is a fundamental change from the past.
I want to come back to that, but let's do a little bit more in history. This is not commercial radio after all. This fellow, Vannevar Bush, and the evolution of federal sponsorship of scientific research and such. Could you tell a little bit of that story after World War II?
Sure. Vannevar Bush is obviously a really important figure in the history of higher education. He is really single-handedly responsible for why the federal government funds research at universities. During World War I, the federal government would disperse monies largely to private companies and to federal research labs, and professors might go and do research in those labs, but the money didn't go directly to the university. In fact, that was seen as a conflict of interest. It was thought that government should not have a direct hand in academic affairs, and they shouldn't fund research directly in the university. And so Vannevar Bush realized after World War II that university contributions to the war were so significant that something needed to be done. There's a famous moment where he essentially declares that the federal government is going to disperse research funding directly to the universities. And he justified this, saying that it was critical that we have a realm in our society where basic research can be performed free of the influence of corporate influence and also political influence. So he was very careful in shaping the federal funding system, that you'd be judged by scientific peers. Whether or not you received funding from the government was determined by a peer review process based on the merits of the research as determined by scientists, not by politicians. And that really was extremely important in ensuring that the political, that what happened in Washington and politics didn't interfere with the progress of science. So in that sense, although there have been periods where the government has intruded on the academic sphere, largely we have a system where federal funding really tries to protect academic autonomy.
Now, to be fair, a lot of that funding came out of the Pentagon, didn't it?
Absolutely. And so what happened was that Vannevar Bush actually intended for a large percent of the federal funding to go through not through specific agencies. He wanted it to essentially be an independent, the National Science Foundation was supposed to be the realm that would disperse most of the money to the universities, and the National Science Foundation.
And not specific cabinet departments or agencies or something like that. But
Right. So the notion was the National Science Foundation would take charge of basic research performed at the university, and it would not be driven by commercial imperatives. But what happened was the National Science Foundation was very slow to be formed. And so very quickly, the military agencies, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, started funneling money into the universities because the National Science Foundation had been delayed in being created. Then the National Institutes of Health, or the precursor to the National Institutes of Health, started dispersing money to the universities. And all of those different agencies are known as mission agencies. They have specific mission, either to advance health or to advance military-industrial interests. And so there's, in that regard, there was a skewing of the federal research funding because the agencies that were dispersing it had an agenda, whereas the National Science Foundation, had the money been available right from the start, might have ensured that the research performed at universities was much more basic and less directed.
I was amazed when I was doing the research for my book Wall Street many years ago some of the early work on modern portfolio theory in finance was financed by the Office of Naval Research.
Actually,
did some fun, some offbeat stuff.
The Office of Naval Research was actually known for being relatively good at continuing to support pretty basic research that didn't have any immediate military application. That's an interesting piece of history.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Washburn, who is the author of University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education, just out from Basic Books. And, this regime continued 50s, 60s expanding. Then, of course, there's the Nixon War on Cancer and a great flood of biomedical money. But then what happened in the 70s? I mean, the economy started collapsing, and then we heard a lot of stuff about the innovation crisis and the productivity crisis and the loss of American leadership.
That's right. And that is exactly when the piece of legislation that I think sort of launched this new academic industrial complex that really we can date it to the 1980s, late 70s, early 80s, when Congress became so concerned about rising competition from Japan and from Germany that it came, essentially there were some people in Congress and in the business community and also actually at universities. They played a very strong hand in trying to push through legislation that basically allowed universities to have automatic rights, automatic intellectual property rights to any research that was funded by the federal government. This was an enormous change because in the past the federal government had always had a preference for not patenting federally funded research and for making it more broadly available.
Well, if we're talking about basic research too, that historically a lot of that hadn't been patented because it was so fundamental and so of such use that there was really no rationale for patenting it. Right?
Exactly. I mean, this is something people don't really realize. We all laud the patent system. It's an extraordinary system, and obviously we want to reward inventors and we want to encourage invention. But the fact is, when research is very, very basic, and it has it generally has such broad applications across so many different sectors that if you patent it and you license it too exclusively to, let's say, one company or even just a handful of companies, there's a danger that you actually restrict scientists from being able to access that basic knowledge that they need to create new discoveries.
And then, of course, Bob Dole and Birch Bayh got together with a bill. Tell us the story of that.
Right. So this piece of legislation is known as the Bayh-Dole Act, named after Birch Bayh and Bob Dole. And basically, they were persuaded. The argument was this. at the time they started trucking out all of these figures about how much research the federal government funds that just sits on the shelf, basically. And it turns out that when I went back and looked at these statistics more carefully, and other academic scholars have done this work more meticulously, that basically the data was totally erroneous. It did not actually support what Congress ended up doing. But essentially they thought, if so much of this federal research is lying on the shelf, then if we allow universities to have the intellectual property rights, that will give them a financial incentive to try to get it out of the university and to industry more quickly. And in exchange, they'll earn these royalties on whatever commercial products result from those inventions. And so they didn't really bother themselves with the issue of conflicts of interest or what was going to happen when the university now had a direct financial interest in its own research, and when professors started to have a direct financial interest in their own research. They didn't really trouble themselves with that. They were only thinking about trying to stimulate innovation. So there have been a lot of really dangerous fallouts from this piece of legislation, but the idea was a noble one, which was to try to speed the transfer of academic ideas to industry.
Now, in many ways, the prototypical bad deal or troublesome deal, which you open the book with, is the one between University of California at Berkeley and Novartis. Tell us that story.
Yeah, this is a contract that was signed in 1980. It lasted 1998, and it lasted until 2003. And it was a five-year, $25 million agreement where Novartis, the biotechnology company, would fund up to one-third of the research, about approximately one-third of the research budget of the Department of Plant and Microbial Biology at UC Berkeley, a public university. So suddenly, this particular deal caused quite an uproar on campus, because you had one private corporation funding approximately a third of the budget of an entire department at a public institution. And people started to really raise questions. I mean, prominent journals, the Nature started to write editorials questioning whether or not the university was essentially leasing itself out to one private company, and what would this mean for...
And this is at a moment that California was cutting its state subsidies to the university.
That's right. So at the same time you have these, and this is happening nationally, I mean, so this is really paradigmatic of what's happening throughout the country. Actually, the share of state budgets going to fund the general budget for higher education has dropped by more than a third since 1980. So as public funding is declining, universities are becoming more and more desperate for funding. They're turning to industry, and increasingly they're allowing industry to dictate the terms of the research support. So you're seeing increases in delays on publication, more requirements that industry be allowed to review a professor's manuscript before it's actually published. In many cases, they edit the manuscripts before it's published. I mean, it's really astonishing when you look at these contracts, the breach of academic freedom that's going on in the biomedical arena. Universities are actually allowing their corporate sponsors to control the raw data from their clinical trials. And what that means is that the professors don't even control the raw data from their research, and they can't even actually say what the whole clinical trial results are, because they don't control the data.
And there's also some disturbing, before I get to that, historically universities have been, or at least in our fantasy, places, relatively open places where people talk about their results. Scientific experiments are supposed to be openly disclosed and reproducible. And now we're bringing in this corporate ethic of secretiveness and competitiveness. What's this done to the way universities function?
Yeah, I'd like to, we haven't talked about students yet, so maybe I'll sort of tell a story that just illustrates how this proprietary culture really conflicts with the academic culture that as we've always known it. I interviewed in the book. I interviewed some students at Stanford University, graduate students who were working in a very very top cutting edge lab, and essentially it became clear that they left this professor's lab. He's a very star professor at Stanford, and I'd gotten wind of this, and I asked them, well, why did you leave his lab? You know, you were at the top of your game. I mean, as an academic, that was an extraordinary lab to be in. Turns out the reason they left is because the professor had his own company on the side. And the minute he had become involved in becoming the, you know, financially involved in this outside commercial effort, he started to neglect the students in the academic lab. And at one point, the students were shocked to discover that their own research, which was actually going toward their own PhD thesis, they thought, had been siphoned off to his company and appearing in company presentations without their knowledge. So you get these very, very difficult questions of who owns the rights to these ideas. And in the university context, that never used to be a problem. But now suddenly the professor is literally competing with his own students over who's going to control any ideas that might have commercial value.
And then, of course, there's a lot of the sensational items that's made the newspapers about how drug companies are controlling experiments that appear as papers in medical journals. What's going on? Give us some examples of what's going on with that.
Yeah, it's really amazing. We've seen so much in the press now, Vioxx and Celebrex and all of the antidepressant drugs, the SSRIs they're called, serotonin reuptake inhibitors. That whole class let's just take the antidepressants. So it turns out that historically universities played this really critical role in making sure that the clinical research studies that were performed to test these drugs were independent and scientifically sound, and essentially they ensured that the results were accurate and not just influenced by corporate marketing departments. So along with these changes that we've seen is the loss of an independent research realm. It turns out that when you go and you look at the antidepressant research that was done, the FDA went back and looked at the raw data, and they found something very disturbing. The academic scientists who had authored these very prestigious articles that had shown that these antidepressants were effective in teens and children in treating depression, the academic studies actually said that they were effective, and they said there were no bad side effects. Turns out when the FDA went back and looked at the raw data, they found that the instances of children who were on these depressants actually suffering higher rates of suicidal behavior, two times greater risk of suicidal behavior among the children and the children who were taking the antidepressants as opposed to just a sugar pill. So the FDA, you know, suddenly thought, well, what's going on here? How can it be that these academic studies said one thing and the raw data says another? Well, it turns out that this again goes back to who's controlling the data from these trials. Increasingly, universities are signing agreements that allow industry to control the raw data. Often the professors are basically relinquishing their independent control over the studies. And they're perfectly happy to lend their names to studies, give them an aura of prestige and objectivity, but their names are on papers that actually downplay very serious side effects that the public had a right to know.
All right, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thanks for joining us, Jennifer Washburn, author of the book University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education, just out from Basic. And a reminder that Jennifer will be reading at Blue Stockings, an excellent bookstore, important place. If you don't, it's not on your regular list of spots to visit. Blue Stockings should be this Wednesday, February 23rd, 7 p.m. Blue Stockings is on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, 172 Allen Street between Stanton and Rivington, one block south of the intersection of Houston and First. Nearest subway is the F train. Second Avenue stop. Good luck with the book. Thanks for coming in, Jennifer.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
And I'll be back in just a little bit with John Wiener.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
Hi, this is Joe Strummer, and you're listening to WBAI, And it's all mixed up. And it's mixed in, too.
And my hero, Iggy Pop, there. And this is Doug Henwood, the show Behind the News. Just before Iggy Pop, you heard some more of Paul Van Dyke's Go Mix from the year 2000. Sounded very much like the first excerpt, but if you're listening closely, it was subtly different. And now we're joined in the studio by John Wiener, author of the book Historians in Trouble. I need new glasses. Plagiarism, Fraud, and Politics in the Ivory Tower, just out from the New Press. And also host of a show on our sister station, KPFK, in Los Angeles. Welcome to the WBAI studios, John.
Doug, it's great to be here.
And welcome to New York City.
Thank you.
I think I'll bring up War Churchill later. Once okay, we set this,
fine.
This is a nice context here. Historians in trouble. Are historians a particularly trouble-prone profession?
Well, I think there's more public and media attention to historians than, I don't know, sociologists or literary scholars, because they carry the official memory of our nation's history. So all the issues of patriotism, loyalty, what is an American, what did the founding fathers mean? Historians are in charge of explaining and understanding that. So I think there's more of a focus on what they have to say than sociologists or literary figures.
Of course, this is a country with a rather poor collective memory, and one of our most famous industrialists declared history to be bunk. So you're swimming upstream in some ways, aren't you?
Nevertheless, when historians cross the line to challenge the prevailing conservative ideologies, suddenly we discover history is not bunk at all, but you can get in a lot of trouble.
Yes, and you've got what? Seven or eight of them?
Well, actually, I've got a dozen, but they fall. There are several different ways historians have gotten in trouble. Some historians accused of misconduct end up on page one of the Times and have their careers destroyed, but others similarly accused of misconduct, seemingly serious misconduct, end up being honored by the Bush White House. And then there's a third group where they get ignored. Nobody seems to care. So one of the things I try to do in this book is figure out why is that?
Well, let's go through some of the case studies and then return to the why is that question. First of all, Elizabeth Fox Genovese, who has had, like her husband, a very interesting ideological evolution over the years.
Yeah, Elizabeth Fox Genovese was one of the co-editors of Marxist Perspectives, which published only 10 issues starting in the late 70s. Some of your older readers may remember or even have subscribed to Marxist Perspectives. Anyway, Elizabeth Fox Genovese is also a prominent historian of the American South and the founding director of the Institute for Women's Studies at Emory University. About 5 years ago, she was sued for sex discrimination and sexual harassment by her assistant at the Women's Studies Center. The plaintiff, a middle-aged mother of four, as she was described in the media, claimed that she was required to perform tasks not required of male assistants at Emory, including walking Elizabeth Fox Genovese's dog, picking up her laundry, and serving at her dinner parties. This was about to go to trial. 100 witnesses were lined up.
I know some journalists who require that of their interns, but I won't name any names. Okay, so carry on.
Yes. Actually, some people have said to me, well, professors who have dogs really get upset at this point, and they say, well, walking a dog is a pleasure. It's not a indictable offense. Well, it is if you're requiring this of your graduate students as a condition of signing their dissertations and writing letters of recommendation for them. Anyway, this was what the plaintiff claimed. Her name was Virginia Gould, and this was about to go to trial in Atlanta. Dozens of prominent historians and Emory students and staff had signed sworn affidavits, were prepared to testify. The jury was in the jury box. The national media, including a CBS show, 48 Hours, no longer with us, was ready to roll. When the judge announced a settlement of the case, Emory paid a settlement to the plaintiff. Elizabeth Fox Genovese said she felt betrayed by this. settlement is secret. Some people have told me it was $1 million. In the 2 weeks ago, I was told by someone who claimed to know that at Emory, the rumor is the plaintiff was paid $3 million for the sins of Elizabeth Fox Genovese. Nevertheless, Elizabeth Fox Genovese last year was awarded the National Humanities Medal by George Bush in a ceremony in the East Room of the White House. So one of the interesting questions here is, how did Elizabeth Fox Genovese get from the courtroom in Atlanta to the East Room in the White House?
Well, she also moved to the right over the years, so she's kind of a conservative icon. So would this have anything to do with it?
You were on the right track. During the same period in which she was being sued, she published a book called "Feminism Is Not the Story of My Life." And what happened in her case was that the complaints against her were spun by the right-wing media to portray her as a victim of feminist political correctness, as a person who stood up for her principles in the face of attack from the left, and therefore a person to be honored. And because somehow the right was able to control the framing of the story of her misconduct.
Somehow, I can't imagine how.
Somehow, it turned into a story of her heroic resistance rather than a story of misconduct.
Although you collect some reports that make it sound like she's not a very pleasant person to be around either.
Well, what I did was I found in the county courthouse in DeKalb County the sworn depositions of the people who were prepared to testify against her, some of the most prominent historians in the United States, some of her most important colleagues at Emory. There seemed to be a consensus that she did require her assistants and indeed her grad students to walk her dog, pick up her laundry, serve at her dinner parties, clean her house. Her students felt terrorized and intimidated she also treated her colleagues and her former colleagues with contempt and abuse. This is all in sworn statements. Now, we don't know for sure whether this is actually true because it never got to trial. She did have a defense prepared, but Emory preferred to settle rather than try to refute those charges, which suggests that Emory believed at least they had some kind of merit.
But we don't know exactly the amount, but she evidently cost Emory a lot of money, and Emory, of course, has a pretty large endowment courtesy of the Coca-Cola Company and other Atlanta potentates. But why would the university turn a blind eye to this kind
this
would cost them a lot of money?
Yes, this is one of the puzzles here. Abuse of staff and students and sexual discrimination against staff is a violation of Emory's own rules as well as a violation of civil rights, federal civil rights legislation. In other cases where faculty members were charged with abusive treatment of staff, those faculty members, and in particular law professor David Garrow, one of the biographers of Martin Luther King, wrote the book The FBI and Martin Luther King. He was accused by a staff member of abusive treatment. There was a distinguished panel of his colleagues in the law school appointed to investigate the charges against him. He was penalized. He was given leave without pay for a period. It seemed to me that Emory should have engaged in the same kind of internal disciplinary fact-finding in the case of Elizabeth Fox Genovese that they did in the case of David Garrow, but for some reason they didn't.
For some reason. I'm speaking with John Wiener, author of the book Historians in Trouble, professor at the University of California, Irvine, and also a producer at KPFK in Los Angeles, our sister station out on the West Coast. She had a colleague at Emory, Michael Belisle.
Belisle. We call him French pronunciation Belisle.
Belisle, okay. What was his problem?
Well, this is sort of Emory has had a lot of historians in trouble. Michael Belisle is best known as the author of a book called Arming America, which was a history of our gun culture. And it won prizes, got a lot of terrific reviews. He argued that our present gun culture does not stem from the early days of the founding father, but is a much more founding fathers, but is a much more recent construction. It dates from the Civil War era when mass manufacture of guns became widespread and millions of men were given guns for the first time by the government. Belial, some of your listeners may recall, was attacked first by the NRA, Charlton Heston, and then by historians who argued that his research was erroneous, mistaken, deeply flawed, and some said fraudulent. In his case, Emory appointed a distinguished panel of outside scholars, paid them a lot of money, I was told $10,000 a person, to investigate his footnotes. They concluded he was guilty of misleading readers, but only in the tiniest portion of the book, one table that was referred to a handful of times in a 400-page book. They said he omitted two crucial years. It was covered 100 years of gun ownership in America. And because he was found guilty of attempting to deceive his readers, he resigned a tenured position at Emory. Now, seems to me the only reason people went after his footnotes was that he had aroused very powerful opponents, the gun lobby, the National Rifle Association, and their media machine. You probably don't read the website shooters.com or keepandbeararms.com, but they said a lot of very nasty things about Michael Belial, and the result is today he is unemployed while his colleague, Elizabeth Fox Genovese, is the holder of the National Humanities Medal.
And his fundamental argument was not judged to be flawed. Was it a matter of interpretation?
The review committee that found him guilty of misconduct refused to comment on whether the flaws they found in his research had any significance for his overall thesis. And when I asked them individually, I know all of these people, they're famous, well-known people, whether they thought this had these charges had any bearing on his thesis about the origins of gun culture in America, they refused to answer. The book is a very eclectic book. It has dozens of varieties of types of evidence, and you know, it's an easy way to go after an author, to find some flaw in the footnotes and say, well, this proves that there's something deeply wrong, corrupt, or fraudulent about the book. Then you don't have to look at the ideas. You don't have to confront the rest of the evidence. And that's what happened to Michael Belial.
Someone who got away with a lot, Alan Weinstein.
Alan Weinstein was confirmed as Archivist of the United States this week by the Senate and sworn in. I think maybe even yesterday he was sworn in. Another Bush nominee, this one accused of misconduct, but his misconduct was ignored. Many years ago, around 1979 or 1980, he published a book on the Alger Hiss case called Perjury. Alger Hiss was accused of being involved in Soviet espionage by Whitaker Chambers, and this was sort of a key moment in the rise of McCarthyism and Richard Nixon in American history.
You can still find some people around town who are obsessed with this case.
Some people, but perhaps even at WBAI. It still remains open to debate of whether Alger Hiss was guilty. But Weinstein claimed to have new evidence, namely interviews with ex-communists who he quoted as saying that indeed Alger Hiss was a spy for the Soviet Union, and that for many people settled the case. Victor Navasky, editor of The Nation magazine at the time, went to the first six people who Weinstein interviewed, and every one of them said that they had not said what they had been quoted as saying, that their interviews had been misquoted, misconstrued, or otherwise distorted. Well, what you're supposed to do in this case, if you're the author, and what Weinstein agreed to do was make the tapes of the interviews public, because it often happens, you know, that people you interview, when they see how their interviews came out, get upset and say that, well, that isn't what I meant. So Weinstein promised to deposit the interviews that were the basis of this book at the Truman Library in Joplin, Missouri. He never did it. He signed a deed of gift promising the library he would turn this stuff over. He's required to do that by the Code of Ethics of the Society of American Archivists and by the American Historical Association. If you're an oral historian and you do interviews, these aren't your private property. You're supposed to deposit these in an archive. Weinstein promised to do so. He never did it. He stonewalled his critics for 25 years until last September when he was nominated by George Bush to be Archivist of the United States. And last week, the Senate confirmed him, and this week he was sworn in. So now he's in charge of the secrets of the United States government. The archivist is a person who we hope would be an advocate for openness and serving the public, which has an interest in learning what government is doing. Of course, the president, not just Bush, but every president, hopes the archivist will help keep their secrets. Weinstein is a guy who has refused to share his own archives, even though he was required to do so by the ethics of the profession. It seems like the Bush administration looked at Weinstein and said, here's a guy who stonewalled the public for 25 years.
He's our kind of guy.
He's our kind of guy.
Yes, I'm speaking with John Wiener, author of the book Historians in Trouble, just out from the New Press. Someone else in your book who got very, very different kinds of treatment from what Alan Weinstein got was David Abraham, a name from, 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah, David Abraham was a historian of fascism in Germany, who wrote a very interesting book about big business in Germany and their support for fascism. At the time, he was an assistant professor coming up for tenure at Princeton. What happened in his case was that his work challenged the work of a conservative senior man in the field, Henry Ashby Turner, a Yale professor of German history, recently retired, I think. And Turner took out after Abraham, again through this technique of checking his footnotes. And sure enough, David Abraham took lousy footnotes. He'd screwed up some of his citations. He had mistranslated things. They weren't anything very important, but they were, his research had been sloppy. Henry Turner and a colleague of his at Berkeley named Gerald Feldman then launched a national campaign to, first of all, to see that Princeton didn't give tenure to David Abraham. And then when
Abraham's thesis was that industrialists in Germany were more friendly to Hitler than people would like to say.
This is not really a very controversial view. In particular, he looked at the collapse of the Weimar Republic and the role of big business in sort of undermining the Weimar Republic, which was the democratic government that was established in Germany after World War II. So it's not directly about Hitler or the Holocaust. It's about the failure of democracy in Germany and the role of big business in bringing about the failure of democracy in Germany. Everywhere David Abraham applied for a job, these two guys wrote threatening letters and said, if you appoint him, we're going to take this to your trustees, we're going to take this to your president, we're not going to rest. And sure enough, nobody would hire David Abraham. So David Abraham ended up being unemployed, although his book was reissued in a second and corrected edition. It's still available from Holmes and Meyer. So here's a case where
he went to law school, didn't he?
David then went to law school, and today he is a professor of law at the University of Miami, who was quoted regularly on the front page of the New York Times during the Alien Gonzalez case because he's one of the leading experts on family immigration law in the United States. So he you know, they say there's no second acts in America. David Abraham is having a very good second act, but no thanks to his senior colleagues in the German history field.
And then was that a matter of politics or personal professional rivalry that we're driving now?
Well, it seemed to me like the really one lesson you could take from this case if you're a graduate student contemplating a dissertation topic is the David Abraham case shows that you should not challenge conservative senior men in the field. At least if you're going to do that, you better make sure that all your footnotes are right.
How many books could survive that kind of determined kind of fact-checking from heavyweights in the
field?
Well,
that is a very interesting question. One of my colleagues says the basic problem here is that no one, what he calls the baseline problem, it's kind of a scientific concept. We don't know what the baseline of error in footnotes is, because nobody's footnotes ever get checked unless someone is after them for some other reason. So we all live in fear, I certainly do, that there's some big problems in the footnotes to my book, Historians in Trouble. We did a lot of work with fact-checking. We went over everything, but I'm sure there's a few things that are wrong there. The answer to your question is we don't know what the typical rate of error is in footnotes, because the only people who get checked are people who are in trouble for other reasons.
And so let's turn to someone not in your book, someone who's in a lot of trouble right now, not a historian, but he's in a lot of trouble, War Churchill. And a lot of people going out after his quality of his scholarship, as well as what he said in his 9/11 essay.
Well,
what do you think of this?
You've set this up perfectly, because Ward Churchill fits the pattern that I've described. Ward Churchill's footnotes are being checked, and it has been found he made some mistakes in his footnotes, in some cases some pretty big ones. I never knew too much about the Mandan before, but in the 1830s, there was an epidemic of smallpox among the Mandan. This was an Indian tribe in what's today the Dakotas. It's long been kind of a legend, I certainly heard it, that the smallpox epidemic was started intentionally by the American Army, which gave infected blankets to the Indians. And Ward Churchill says this in one of his books. He has a footnote to a prominent anthropologist at UCLA as the source of this information, but the prominent anthropologist at UCLA says that's completely wrong. His research disproved this legend. The Mandan got smallpox not from blankets given to them intentionally by the army, but by travelers getting off of a riverboat. No one is sure how they got smallpox. It wasn't a conspiracy to commit genocide by the army. Ward Churchill's wrong, apparently, according to this leading scholar in the field. Well, why? But we have to ask, well, why is this happening now? It isn't because people really care a lot about the Mandan all of a sudden in, February of 2005. What's happened is that Ward Churchill is in trouble for his political statements, for his statement that some of the victims of the 9/11 attack on the Twin Towers were, in his phrase, little Eichmanns. I don't agree with that. I kind of know what he's driving at here. But the fact is, we can disagree with Ward Churchill's speech, but of course he has a right to his opinions. That's not a left-wing position. That's not some Marxist position. That's what the Bill of Rights is about. That's what the First Amendment is about. That's called freedom of speech. And the only reason they're checking his footnotes, the only reason the governor is threatening to fire him, is not because of the quality of his scholarship. It's because of his objectionable political statements. So here's another case where the footnotes become the pretext in a political fight.
And actually, one of the people who's doing this fact-checking, Thomas Brown, a sociologist at Lamar University,
yeah,
says...
Who is he?
Well, I happen to know that he said it on the mailing list that I run that he chose to do this now because people would pay attention. They wouldn't have noticed if people weren't concentrating on Ward Churchill. And he purports to be not a right-winger, if anything, on the left politically, but he thought people would pay attention now to his work. So
he's right. He's right about that.
But
I mean, the governor of Colorado has said, you know, Ward Churchill should be fired. But you can't. Even the governor of Colorado knows you can't fire somebody for speech. You have to find some other more legitimate reason. But the fact is, no one has been fired in the United States for this kind of footnote error or even footnote fraud. If Ward Churchill gets fired, it's because of his political views, not because of his footnotes.
And if he were on the right, he'd be getting away with it, maybe even getting appointed to high office by the president, right? Thanks for joining us, John Wiener. John Wiener, author of the book Historians in Trouble, also a professor at the University of California, Irvine, and the host of a show on KPFK in Los Angeles, the Pacifica outlet in Southern California. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this song with absolutely no political content at all. collaboration of Nona Hendrickson material, Bustin' Loose, from about 20 years ago. Bye.